Resolute on Russian hacking, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. America's top spies tell Congress they're even more resolute now in their view that Russia hacked the U.S. election. This cybersecurity expert says the Russians didn't even worry about getting caught.
They wanted to complete their espionage and then leak this information to the public. But they didn't care later on if experts came in and attributed it to them.
Also, some California officials have a message for the Trump administration.
You want to come in and enforce immigration law? It's okay. It's fine. You can do that. Just know that we are not going to use our manpower, our resources to do that.
Plus, how Carmel, Indiana fell in love with the roundabout. All ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World.
I'll wrap up by saying, after 53 years in intelligence business in one capacity or another, happily, I've just got 15 days left.
A weary-sounding James Clapper, Director of National Intelligence. He was speaking there at a hearing of the Senate Armed Services Committee on cyber threats to the United States. And yes, there was a lot of talk at the hearing about Russia's alleged hacking of the U.S. election and President-elect Trump's mistrust of the U.S. intelligence community. Chris Porter was following the hearing closely. He's a manager with the cybersecurity firm FireEye.
In a lot of ways, the intelligence community is confirming the long-held views that we've had here at FireEye, that these activities were sponsored by the Russian government. Also, that the Russian cyber threat actors may have put more effort into making their efforts plausibly deniable as opposed to trying to avoid attribution outright. And although Director Clapper sort of declined to provide evidence for that, I think that'll be an interesting discussion to watch going into the future, is exactly what was Russia's risk tolerance.
I want to go back to just the nuts and bolts of this. What has it been determined that Russia did?
I'll say at FireEye, there's a great deal of technical evidence that the Russian threat group APT-28 compromised the DNC and did many of the other election-related hacks that they're accused of.
When you say hack, what do you mean? Like, practically, what did they do?
There's, I think, two important things to understand. One is that the general techniques that they used going after the DNC, the phishing emails, the fake websites, those sort of things, those are techniques that are, in theory, available to a wide range of actors. But the actual software that they used to get into the system and to then gain control of it so that they could steal the information they wanted, those are tools that the Russian government has used for a long time. They're updated versions of long-standing tools.
What about the issue of when we say the Russians did this or that? Are we talking about the Russian government or just Joe and Susie?
Yes.
Russian?
That's an important distinction. So you'll hear different commentators in public raise the specter of, how do you know it was in a different country or an insider or something like that? And those are reasonable alternative theories if you look at it one incident at a time. When you start looking at not just targeting the DNC, but also targeting Eastern European governments and organizations related to the Olympics and targeting European security cooperation organizations, those other theories don't make sense because there's not very many, if any, other actors who would be interested in all of those targets. And the actors that would be interested either wouldn't have the technical skill and investment in cyber programs to do so, or obviously they wouldn't be using known Russian government tools. So when you take all of the evidence together and all of the incidents together, there's very high confidence that this is attributable specifically to the Russian government and not to, for example, someone who's just living in Russia or to another government trying to impersonate Russia.
Before working at FireEye, you worked at the CIA. You briefed the West Wing on cyber threats. And President Obama is getting briefed today on this classified report on Russia's alleged role in cyber attacks during the election. Knowing what you do about briefing the West Wing on cyber threats, what do you expect the president will be hearing today?
Yeah, I don't know substantively what they'll be telling him. I will say in general, what the president's going to get that's unique from the intelligence community is that next step, the ability to perhaps rule out some very elaborate insider threat or some of the other false flag operations. The intelligence community is going to be able to get him to that 95 to 99% confidence. They're going to be able to present different types of sources and methods that will supplement what's already being discussed by the cybersecurity companies and should be even higher confidence. And I hope they'll be sharing that with President-elect Trump as well and being very transparent with their sourcing, because although there's no doubt in my mind that the Russian government conducted some of the initial operations and computer compromises, some of the claims that have been leaked in the press about this being deliberately to get Mr. Trump elected president and so forth. You know, I don't know. This is the part that I'm skeptical of, which is that when you say you have a secret assessment and you have these secret sources and methods, on the forensic side, attributing the actual network operations to Russia, we do have that. But divining intent, I think, is going to be much more difficult. I think it's difficult to disentangle the Russian government just continuing to advance their foreign policy message from the effect on the campaign. You know, they made a decision early on that they were going to undermine confidence in the U.S. election. And to me, that's the real story, is that they wanted to sort of sabotage whoever got elected president.
Chris Porter is with the cybersecurity firm FireEye. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Right on Russia's doorstep are the Baltic nations, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. All three former Soviet republics are now members of NATO. Residents there are nervous, given President-elect Trump's uncertain support for NATO members. And when three U.S. senators traveled to the Baltics recently to offer assurances of American protection, they didn't go on to visit Moscow.
We didn't go to Russia because Senator McCain has been banned from visiting the country by Vladimir Putin.
That's Senator Amy Klobuchar, Democrat from Minnesota. She traveled to the Baltics with Republican Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham. She says the U.S. must make a firm commitment to protecting its allies in the region.
We should be celebrating and supporting these new democracies instead of, you know, making alliances with Vladimir Putin.
President-elect Trump has said pretty negative things about NATO, dismissing it as obsolete. What kind of assurances were you and the two Republican senators with you, John McCain and Lindsey Graham, were you able to give to the Baltic leaders that the U.S. will continue to support the Baltic states?
Well, Senator McCain has talked to the president-elect about NATO, and he feels like they will stand by NATO. On the other hand, we have the statements that the president-elect has made. These countries have seen this movie before. Estonia had the audacity to move a bronze statue of a Russian fighter from a town square to a cemetery. And the reaction of Russia, because they didn't like that, was to actually shut down their computer systems and hack into it. When Lithuania invited members of the parliament from Crimea, who are in exile in Kyiv, they invited them to Lithuania for a show of solidarity for the 25th anniversary of independence. And once again, they were hacked into and cyber attacked by Russia. So what we saw in America was not an isolated incident. It wasn't about one candidate or one political party or even one country. It's a modus operandi that Russia has used in the past and will use in the future unless we stand up for it.
Now, another person who Baltic states, I think, are a little concerned about is the nominee for Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson. He's advocated for a lessening of sanctions on Russia. Did the Baltic leaders discuss him?
It did come up a few times, and we again told them that we were going to thoroughly examine his record. It's been Senator McCain and Senator Graham have made that very publicly clear that they're concerned about his connections to Russia. And in addition to getting that award of friend of Russia from Vladimir Putin, I think what you raised is the bigger issue, is the lessening of the sanctions at a time when we were on the front line in East Ukraine with the Ukrainian troops. They all wanted American troops there as security against the Russian aggression. And to find out that the Secretary of State might be someone that wants to see sanctions lightened or lessened or eliminated was really concerning to these countries.
Do you personally think that there should be kind of deal breaker issues when it comes to Tillerson's nomination? I mean, do you feel like there's certain things that are simply non-negotiable?
For me, any stance that would be in favor of lessening these sanctions or eliminating these sanctions when we're really, there's been no action by Russia in terms of withdrawing from Crimea or eastern Ukraine, that would make you think there should be a lessening of those sanctions. So, yes, that would be a deal breaker for me. In addition to that, outside of the Russia issues, he still, as I understand it, maybe it's changed this week, but he hadn't gotten his tax returns in. And when you look back at the nominees that President Obama put for before they got confirmed and before they were hearings, they had at least their FBI background checks done as well as their ethics forms done. And last time I checked, only three or four of these nominees had that FBI background check done. Most of them didn't have their ethics forms in. We can't go forward with a nominee. You don't go forward with a nominee even for a U.S. attorney without an FBI background check.
What is it like for you personally to be a U.S. senator at a time like this when there's so many contradictory comments coming out of the president-elect's camp on various cherished democratic institutions? I mean, how does that make you feel?
My dad's a reformed alcoholic, so I decided to go with their saying, one day at a time, right? So I look at it one day at a time, and it is disturbing because you want to have consistency in governing, especially for someone like myself who's interested in some of the international issues and been really active on refugee issues. That's concerning because you want to have consistency with foreign leaders.
Senator Amy Klobuchar is a Democrat from Minnesota. She recently returned from a trip to the Baltics with Republican Senators John McCain of Arizona and Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. Thanks so much, Senator Klobuchar.
Thank you.
As we heard, there are concerns about Rex Tillerson's relationship with Russia. But as an oil executive, Tillerson also struck deals with governments in many other nations. That's likely to come up during his confirmation hearings for Secretary of State. Journalist Ben Van Heuvelen was in Baghdad in 2011 when Tillerson was cutting deals for Exxon in Iraq. Ben, set the stage for us. Iraq was recovering from the Second Gulf War. What was Exxon doing there?
Exxon had recently signed an enormous contract to develop Iraq's second largest oil field in Basra. They were also in negotiations to do a major infrastructure project that would be necessary for Iraq to raise its oil production. So they were setting themselves up to be one of the major international companies partnering with the Baghdad government to prop the country back up.
But Rex Tillerson, he also negotiated other oil deals in Iraq as well.
Yes, he did. Just as Exxon was ramping up their projects in Baghdad and southern Iraq with the federal government, Tillerson also greenlighted negotiations with the autonomous Kurdish government in the north. And this became a very controversial move because it effectively inserted Exxon right into the middle of one of the biggest political fault lines in Iraq between majority Arab population and the minority Kurdish population.
How did the deal with the Kurdish officials go down in Baghdad? What was their reaction?
There had for years been disagreements about how to draw the lines of authority over the oil sector in Iraq. The Kurds in the north wanted to have control for themselves, and the federal government in Baghdad thought that this was a national resource that should be managed centrally. So when Exxon came in and signed their deal with the Kurdistan government, they effectively endorsed the Kurdistan government's federalist, decentralized interpretation of the Iraqi constitution.
And how far did the conflict go? I mean, did it really come to blows between central authority in Baghdad and the Kurds?
Almost literally so. The tensions escalated to such a point that there was actually a shootout on the disputed border between the Kurdish territory and federally controlled territory, a small-scale altercation, but that caused each government to send thousands of troops to that disputed border. So there were several months where those troops were, you know, tanks and artillery crews within range of one another's weapons, just sort of staring at each other. And at one point, Prime Minister Maliki, who was prime minister at the time, issued a very direct threat saying that if Exxon were to put a drill in the ground, that they would consider it an act of war.
Wow. Fast forward to right now, and next week, Rex Tillerson is expected to appear before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. What questions should they be asking about his time in Iraq?
I think the very first question is probably related to the Kurdistan deal. What was Rex Tillerson's understanding of U.S. policy in Iraq at the time? And did he put Exxon's business interests above the U.S. policy toward Iraq and the stability of the country?
Ben Van Heuvelen is editor-in-chief of Iraq Oil Report. Thanks a lot for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
This is The World. Every year, 15 million girls around the world get married before they reach the age of 18. It's a sobering figure, and it represents a major human rights violation, according to advocacy groups. Child marriage is most common in developing countries in Africa, the Middle East, and Asia, but now it's an issue that Germany is struggling with. Here's The World's Matthew Bell.
If a woman or a girl living in Germany wants out of an abusive relationship, there's a system in place to help her. But it's not an easy path to freedom, especially for those who come from migrant or refugee families. The way out often starts with a phone call to the police. If the caller says she's looking for a shelter, a women's house, as it's called in German, the cops might put her in touch with someone like Irina Badawi. She works with a network of activists who help women and girls escape violent or abusive situations. They usually arrange a meeting in a public place, like this bus stop. Standing under the bus shelter, Badawi tells me a story about an Afghan girl she met here one night last year. Her papers said she was 20 years old, but Badawi says the girl was actually 16. Back in Afghanistan, she was forced into marriage at the age of 14, and Badawi says the girl ran away. So her family married her to another man who brought her with him to Germany, but she ran away again. Badawi helped her find a place in a safe house. The location of these women's shelters are kept secret. Badawi says the Afghan girl was suicidal, so she received psychiatric care. But now she's studying German and trying to sort out her legal status so she can stay in the country. Women describe this bus stop as almost a second birthplace, Badawi says. For the ones who make it, this can be the start of a whole new life. And that is something she has been through, too. Irina Badawi is a pen name. It's the one she used to tell her story in a new book. She says her own experience as a child bride and her eventual escape are what drive her to help other migrant women and girls in similar situations. Badawi's family is from the Yazidi religious minority. At 16, she says her father forced her to marry a man she hardly knew. He was abusive and violent. He raped her. Badawi says he had total control over her life. But she says her family pressured her to stay with him. They had two children together, but in her mid-20s, she finally decided to get out. Since then, her family and her religious community have ostracized her. Her ex-husband has threatened to kill her, and she still worries for the safety of her kids. That's why she doesn't want me to mention the German city where they live. But Badawi says she will continue to speak out against child marriage.
Eine Kinderehe ist eine Kinderehe und stopp!
Child marriage is a child marriage, Badawi says. There are no ifs, ands, or buts. The German government says there are now 1,500 registered cases of child marriage in Germany. These are mostly among migrants who got married in Syria, Afghanistan, and other parts of the Muslim world, and then entered the country in the last 1 or 2 years. Badawi says the real number of child brides in Germany is much higher because falsified documents are easy to get. Last year, a regional court in the town of Bamberg recognized the marriage of two Syrian refugees, even though the girl was 14, the husband was 20, when they were married back in Syria. The case is being appealed in federal court. The couple's lawyer, Birgit Naamni, says she doesn't condone forced marriage, but she told me that this is a legitimate union under German law.
Germany is not able and it's not possible to decide about the validity of marriages all over the world in about 150 countries. So I have to accept that this marriage, this contract is okay.
German lawmakers are worried that this case could open the door to legal underage marriage. Currently, couples in Germany can get special permission from a family court to get married if one of them is 16 or 17. But new legislation sponsored by Stefan Harbart, a member of the German parliament, would ban all marriages for people under 18. Harbart told me the problem is clear when you look at the legal documents from countries like Syria, where the civil war has pushed many young girls into marriage.
They need the consent, but not the consent, for example, of their mother. They need the consent of the father. So that shows that in reality it's not the decision of the girl herself, but it is the decision of the family. And we want to make sure that everyone is entitled to decide whom he or she wants to marry. That's the decision of each individual and not the decision of a family or of a clan.
There's a lot of denial going on here, Irina Badawi tells me. When she wrote her first article about child marriage, she says the reaction from her Yazidi community was almost entirely negative.
Dann haben das Gemeinschaft, also jesidische Gemeinschaft,
Badawi says people responded on Facebook saying that Yazidis don't force their daughters into marriage and that domestic violence doesn't exist in their community. One small sign of hope, though, she goes on to say, is that some younger people have started to talk about this issue more openly. Maybe that will lead to change. But she says what needs to happen in Germany now is a total ban on child marriage, with no exceptions. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell, Berlin.
When the Syrian government retook Aleppo from the rebels last month, many of the city's residents were evacuated to Idlib. It's a smaller rebel-held city in northwest Syria. The war has caused a lot of damage there, too, and when the sun goes down, Idlib goes quiet and dark. It's just too dangerous to go out at night, and there are very few lights on. Reuters photographer Amar Abdullah saw that as an opportunity to show a different side of the war in Syria.
The idea was to provide a different view of the shelling and bombing, because most of the time, photographers take their pictures of the war zone during the day, and people are used to that. So with night photos, you see everything in a new way.
Abdullah's long exposure photos are beautiful and haunting. You see unusually bright stars in the night sky, framing dark, bombed-out buildings and empty streets. Abdullah admits he took big risks to take the pictures at night.
Yes, it's dangerous to shoot photographs at night. You have to be really careful and you can't use any lighting, because the lights could give away your location and you could get bombed. Also, photographers could get kidnapped.
Abdullah himself is from Idlib and his family's there too, so he knows the city well. In one of his night pictures, you can see the silhouette of a Ferris wheel, a reminder of what life in Idlib used to be like and how it's changed since the war started.
In this picture, you can see an amusement park in a small town in Idlib province. It closed 5 years ago because it wasn't safe anymore for a lot of people to gather there. It became a target for bombs.
Right now, Idlib remains under rebel control, but after the fall of Aleppo, many expect the government may launch an offensive there too. You can see Amar Abdullah's photographs of Idlib at night, and I really hope you do. They're at PRI.org. This is The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills. He's Thailand's military strongman, but he also pens syrupy ballads.
So if you can imagine Michael Bolton as an autocrat who locks up dissidents and vows to restore national purity, that's pretty much in the ballpark.
Call it adult contemporary propaganda. We'll have a sample coming up right here on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. In 15 days, Donald Trump will be sworn in as president. And one of the first things he said he wants to do once in office is to tackle immigration. Trump said early in his campaign that he wanted to deport all immigrants who are in the country illegally. He's since backed off from that sweeping statement, so it's not exactly clear what Trump might do. But officials in some cities across the country are planning to help immigrants in a variety of ways. Tiziana Rinaldi has been writing about this over at PRI.org. She says one major battleground will be immigration courts.
In terms of resources available to immigrants who appear in court, and let's say they are going through a deportation proceedings, which has been very much the focus of a lot of discussion recently, if they cannot afford legal representation, which of course they are entitled to, but if they cannot afford any, very much unlike what we know for the criminal system, for the criminal judicial system, the court, the U.S. Immigration Court, will not assign a public defender. Mm-hmm. So they find themselves in really a difficult situation. Most of the time, there is a language barrier. Certainly, there is a barrier in the capacity to even argue their defense when it comes to such very complex matter as immigration law.
So they have to represent themselves? How does it work if they can't afford a lawyer?
That's correct. That's what's been happening throughout the immigration courts throughout the nation. What has been happening, particularly after the type of campaign we've heard, the presidential campaign we've gone through, and now that we know that Mr. Trump is going to be the president on a platform that was unfavorable to immigrants in general, is that many cities are now deciding to offer or expand access to legal representation.
How are they doing that? Where are they getting the money to do that? And what exactly are they doing?
So what's happening is New York has been leading the way, has been on the forefront of this type of conversation, which is really about bringing what's called due process, which means nothing less than what we by and large interpret as having a fair day in court. What's been done is that resources are being allocated by either cities or, in California now, there's a proposal to do it at the state level. Allocate resources so that public defenders and possibly well-trained public defenders will be assigned to people, especially if they need to fight deportation proceedings, if they are under threat or deportation proceedings, or might be in detention and have to face deportation.
Is it necessarily taxpayer money that's paying for it, or are individuals or foundations or people who want to donate, are they adding money to this effort as well?
It's a mixed effort, depending on the city that we're talking about. For instance, here in New York, it's been mostly funded with taxpayers' money. But, you know, there are considerations throughout the country to also add perhaps humanitarian funds that comes from the humanitarian community or from private funders.
What are critics saying about this idea of putting aside more money to help undocumented immigrants deal with possible deportation?
As you can imagine, because the immigration debate has had so many voices and it's being fought on several fronts, there are also many critics, both inside and outside of government offices. Outside government offices, the most common criticism is, why do we even use taxpayers' money to pay for people who, is being said, are here maybe unlawfully or seem to have not respected the country's immigration laws? Inside government offices, inside legislatures, there are also some tensions, because even when there is an understanding that helping immigrants or at least extending due process might be something that we want to do or might be the right thing to do, there's also a question of what we are using these funds for immigrants' legal funds. Why not, for instance, and I believe this was the argument of Pat Dowell in Chicago, one of the aldermen in the city, why don't we also use this money to fund a legal defense for African-American youth that is being racially profiled?
Tiziana Rinaldi is a reporter based in New York. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
A lot's been written since the election about the role Breitbart News played in Donald Trump's victory, especially after Trump picked Breitbart's former head Steve Bannon as his chief White House strategist. Bannon made the conservative news website a forum for the far right and white supremacists. Now Breitbart is expanding to Germany and France, two European countries with elections coming up and rising support for far-right politicians. In France, that would be Marine Le Pen of the National Front. So can Breitbart make a difference there? My BBC colleague John Lawrenson has that story from Paris.
On this bright, freezing morning, the customers are few and far between at the street market of Mont-la-Ville. This is the only town in the Paris region that elected a National Front mayor. There are plenty of people here who distrust the media.
It's not the news they give you, but telling you how to think. So I've just stopped listening. They try to make you see the world in one way, and that is their way. I've begun thinking that it's the media that rules the world. On the question of immigration, for example, those poor people. If I were in their shoes, I would do the same as them. But we're a little country. The media never look at the question from that point of view. but we can't look after all the world's poor, unfortunately.
The media don't only inform, which is their proper role, they put their slant on things, generally a left-wing slant. It's do this, don't do that, they treat us like idiots. At the moment, for example, the Conservative presidential candidate François Fillon says he wants to cut the number of civil servants, but the media has decided that these jobs are sacred.
And this mistrust of the media has history.
Au 19e siècle, au début du 20e siècle, la presse qui était la plus prisée en France, c'était la presse.
As far back as the 19th century, the French press was always much more partisan than its Anglo-American counterparts. And a huge number of politicians, Clemenceau for example, or Léon Blum, were journalists at the same time.
On dirait premier ministre aujourd'hui, ont été des hommes de presse.
In the bar of a hotel near Saint-Lazare station, where he's about to get on a train, I meet up with Jean-Marie Charon, probably the foremost authority on French journalism and the media, and author of a string of books on the subject.
After World War II, Charles de Gaulle replaced papers that had stayed open during the occupation with ones like Le Monde, where politician journalists from the resistance were in charge. Nowadays, what people complain about most is that journalists don't care about the things that common people care about, because they come from the same Parisian elite as the politicians.
And it's here that that media mistrust is charted, at the Catholic daily La Croix. Every year, this newspaper commissions a poll on people's confidence in the media, which shows, well, that they don't have very much, and that indeed they have less and less. Half the French now say they don't trust the TV news, for example. Might some of them be in the market for a product like Breitbart, even though there are already French language sites like Français de Souche, native French, on what its critics like to call the fascio sphere? La Croix's editor is Jean-Christophe Ploquin.
The sites that you mentioned are not very well financed, you know. It's quite amateurish. Maybe a trademark like Breitbart could really have the same impact as Netflix on the video online. When you have a very strong company coming in a landscape, it could have a very big effect.
Back in Mont-la-Ville, I duck into a cafe after a failed attempt to get an interview with the National Front mayor. It's a tricky one, this, for the French nationalists. Breitbart is, after all, foreign media. Is America where the French should be going for their French news? But the youngest of the Le Pen clan, Marion Maréchal Le Pen MP, has gone on record welcoming Breitbart's decision to open here. All alternative media are generally positive, she said. Donald Trump is the demonstration of that.
The BBC's John Lawrenson reporting from Paris. It was supposed to be a fun New Year's Eve celebration, but for several women in the Indian city of Bangalore, the start of 2017 will be memorable for all the wrong reasons. The celebration ended with the women being groped and harassed on the streets by groups of men. The attacks were recorded on phones and the videos shared on social media. The whole incident has sparked outrage in India and around the globe. My colleague Chavi Sachdev has been following the story. She joins me from Mumbai. Chavi, what happened to these women on Saturday night?
For a lot of women who were out celebrating the first night, they ended up being groped and molested by a mob of drunken men out in a space that should have been safe for them. So a really horrible start to the year. They were out at about midnight, and apparently there were roving groups of men between, I would say, 30 men to 300 men that these women had to walk past, and it was just a free-for-all where they were just grabbing their bodies and touching them as they moved through this crowd to wherever they were trying to get to.
And so there's kind of online videos and things that have been shared on social media that show this very thing going on.
That's right. And a lot of people have come forward on TV, in the newspapers and on blogs to talk about what happened to them. But it's been very strange because the authorities are actually contradicting the eyewitness accounts, and they're saying that they have no such cases on file or on record.
What's been the public reaction to both the incident and to the sort of kind of ho-hum response by the police?
So online, there's been a lot of anger. You know, in 2012, we had that really, really awful rape case where this girl was raped on a moving bus by a bunch of men. And everybody in India sort of was outraged and really was holding their breath to see that things would change for women.
And she eventually died from her attack.
From her, yes, because it was so brutal. And we had put, the citizenry had put a lot of faith in the processes being revamped so that there would be recourse for women in public spaces. And this incident has just sparked off so much outrage because it's so clear that that has not happened, that there is a failure of the system again. So there are protests, there are petitions, there's a lot of anger. And I'm hearing it from all directions. It's all anybody can talk about.
There's also been some very kind of blatantly sexist or just kind of creepy remarks by authorities, like the women along the kind of the women asked for it theme of they were dressed like Westerners. I mean, what's been the response to that?
So this victim shaming and victim blaming is very much entrenched in our culture. We have a very patriarchal society, and there's been also a lot of backlash towards that. So this not all men hashtag had been trending for a while, where all these guys were like, yeah, but all men are not like that. And the women have now responded by this with this hashtag of yes, all women. And they've been documenting in public, in social media, all the experiences that women have had in public spaces, whether it's groping. And, you know, in India, we have this euphemism. We call it Eve teasing, which trivializes it so much. It makes it sound like, oh, just something boys do. And that's sort of the mindset that the girls and the women now are challenging, and they're trying to take back their public spaces. And there's also on ground events happening. So there's an organization called Why Loiter that tries to reclaim public spaces. And other organizations are trying to mobilize women all over the country to stand up in protest about this Western culture narrative that's being imposed on them, because it's not about what you wear, right? It's about being safe and having a citizenry behave itself with respect.
You know, on a crowded New Year's Eve after midnight, there were a lot of women out there. There's usually safety in numbers. What happened?
From the eyewitness accounts and from the first person narratives, it seems like even if there were three or five women with boys with them, they're no match against a group of 30 to 100 men who are all out there surrounding them and then enclosing you, like engulfing you, so that you have to pass through them to exit. And then everybody is just out there. They're just hands touching you from all sides. It sounds horrific. And I don't think any number of people is enough to take that on.
Are the police in Bangalore saying that nothing happened to the women, or are they simply objecting to the notion that it was kind of a mass attack of women?
It's the latter. They're trying to say that nothing on this scale happened and that it wasn't as full blown as the media is making it sound, or the outrages indicating that it was. And they're also saying that nobody has come forward to put statements out, which is directly contradicted by people who say that they tried to approach the police, but the police didn't seem like they could do anything about it.
Reporter Chavi Sachdev in Mumbai. Thanks so much, Chavi.
My pleasure, Carol.
I'm Carol Hills with The World. If you want to start a fight here in Boston, you might just mention your love of rotaries. You know, big old traffic circles at major intersections. A lot of Boston drivers hate rotaries with a passion. Things might be different if we had more roundabouts. That's what they use in Britain. Roundabouts are traffic circles too, but they work a little differently. And there's one city in America that has so many of them that it's been nicknamed Roundabout USA. Carmel, Indiana. Jim Brainerd is the mayor there.
I was fortunate to spend a term during law school in England and saw roundabouts being used there, and they seemed to handle so much more traffic. So after I became mayor, I started to do some research, convinced some of our consulting civil engineers to build a few roundabouts. We have. They work so well and are so much safer that we now have 102 in our city of about 100,000 people, more than any other city, regardless of size, in the United States.
And before you, were there no roundabouts, or were there a few and you decided, let's make more of them?
There were no roundabouts.
Hmm. How did Carmel, Indiana respond to the first roundabout?
Well, it was a brand new road that we were building on the edge of the developed area. And so people really didn't see them during the construction period. We opened the road, which everybody loved, and it had some roundabouts on it. And then we started to do a lot of public education about why we had built it that way. And people in Carmel love it. We can remove our roundabout today if we wanted to. The fights tend to be over which intersection is going to be the next one to be converted from a stoplight to a rotary.
Is Carmel mostly a newish city that is developing, and there's a lot of new building and new development, and the roundabouts are going into the new places, or are you retrofitting old places as well?
Both. It is a new city. At the end of World War II, it still had under 1,000 people. It was a small, rural farming community. Today, we're just under 100,000 in population. When I became mayor in 1996, we had about 29,000. So you can see there's been very quick growth. And initially, we put the roundabouts in the new areas. But then as time has gone on, they have become so popular among the people living in Carmel and traveling into Carmel for business. We have a large commercial core that we've started to retrofit existing stoplights with roundabouts. And in fact, we have 28 more planned over the next 2 years, and they're all replacing current stoplights.
Now, we have a new presidential administration coming in, Donald Trump. Do you think that he and his administration will embrace this idea and give it more funding? I mean, he has said he's into infrastructure.
Well, I hope so. Federal transportation law already has some incentives built into the law to build roundabouts over the stoplights. It's called the congestion mitigation section. So if you meet, if a city has certain amounts of congestion, you're allowed to get more than the standard 80% for a roundabout. In fact, you can go all the way up to 100% funding if the money's available to build a roundabout. Partially, one of the things that people don't think about, not only do they move far more traffic per hour, because of the lack of idling and the lack of starting from a dead stop, our city engineer has estimated that we're saving thousands of gallons of gasoline per roundabout per year as well.
It's amazing. It's amazing to hear about this kind of stuff in a city like Carmel compared to what we experience here in Boston. But I wish you luck. And James Brainerd is the mayor of Carmel. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Well, it's been great to be with you, Carol.
And finally today, this musical gem. That's the song Bridges, written by Thailand's strongman ruler Prayut Chan-o-cha. It's his fourth release, believe it or not, and the World's Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok places the tune in the genre of adult contemporary propaganda.
To me, it sounds very John Tesh or maybe Michael Bolton. So if you can imagine Michael Bolton as an autocrat who locks up dissidents and vows to restore national purity, that's pretty much in the ballpark.
What is he saying in these songs that he's writing?
Well, as you mentioned, the new song is called Sapan, which means bridges. And basically, the prime minister is saying he will be the bridge between Thailand's chaotic past and its brilliant future. Some sample lyrics here. I'll be the bridge for you to cross. I'll take you to the place of your dreams. I'll be the bridge, taking you to the land of refreshing comfort. Our dreams will come true. This is basically the Thai version of Make Thailand Great Again.
What's his interest in releasing these songs? What's behind it?
Well, it's propaganda, but he's also, this is his way of communicating with the Thai public. There's several themes we can draw out. The main one is that Prayut and the army in general, they see themselves as the savior of Thailand. Usually it's saving the country from those dirty, corrupt elected officials so that, you know, good-hearted military generals can run the country. And that's, of course, propaganda. The other thing you hear in these songs is the phrase, just give us a little more time. So right after the Prayut staged a coup in 2014, he released a pop song saying, just give us a little time to run the country and we'll fix everything. It's 2.5 years later. And in the new song that we heard earlier, he's also saying, just give us a little more time.
So how does the saccharine sound of this song compare to how he addresses the Thai people when he speaks to them?
This doesn't really match up with his public persona all that well. He's a very gruff guy. He tends to talk to the nation like a stern father or almost sometimes a grumpy uncle. He even came up with this list of core values that he likes to lecture the Thai people on, which is, you know, respect your elders, don't go shopping too much. Kind of begs the question, why is a guy that overthrew the government, you know, lecturing us about appropriate behavior? You know, on a more serious note, this is a leader whose military has thrown people in prison just for clicking like on a subversive Facebook meme. Dissent is treated as treason, and people have been detained on army camps. So no, his real-life persona is not nearly as cuddly.
So what can we learn from these songs about the leader of Thailand, Prayut Chan-o-cha?
Well, like I said, it's propaganda. This is a way of making him seem more relatable or more friendly or more, you know, emotionally invested in the future of Thailand. And again, he's saying, you know, I'm your rightful leader just for a little bit longer. You know, let's put off elections. There's no rush. Just give me more time to fix everything. And in the lyrics, you hear him portraying Thailand as having this sort of very pious, amazing past that he wants to return to. And he can be the bridge that will take the Thai people there. Exactly when the country will see elections and when he wants to turn over the keys to the country is a complete mystery.
The world's Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok. Thanks, Patrick.
Thanks a lot, Carol.
We'll let the latest track from Thailand's ruler Prayut Chan-o-cha take us out today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for tuning in.
หัวใจเมื่อต้องเจอแม่น้ำเชี่ยวกรากอุปสรรคที่แสนยิ่งใหญ่จะพาเธอ
PRI Public Radio International